My name is Mark Sloboda. I'm an international affairs and security analyst based in Moscow. My background is I was American. I served in the U.S. military. I was in the nuclear engineering field in the U.S. Navy. And after that, I went back to school to study international relations and political science with a specialty in security studies, the military aspects, the strategic aspects of it. I started my studies in Russia and then finished them. I did my postgraduate work in the London School of Economics and Political Science. After that, I have taught international relations and security studies at Moscow State University, which is the largest and most prestigious university in Russia. I have emigrated to Russia. I am now a Russian citizen. I work a lot with the media, the Russian media, media around the world, political analysis. My day job is still teaching. And my wife, by the way, full disclosure, is Crimean. She's Russian from Crimea. And I have my in-laws still live in Simferopol in the Crimea. And we have extended family all across East Ukraine, Kharkov, Odessa, Donbass, just to give you an idea of full disclosure of my biases and my, you know, shall we say, firsthand experience and relations for the subject.
Well, I mean, as somebody that was privy to some U.S. nuclear secrets, some might say, Mark, that you've defected to the other side.
Yeah, that is a Cold War framing of the issue. Actually, I emigrated. None of the, quote, secrets, unquote, that I had are actually of any interest to Russia, because actually, you know, running a nuclear reactor on a warship is actually 1950s, 1960s tech with very little update, and they have all the same things. So no one has ever asked me anything about that background, which was actually a little surprising. I thought someone might have at one point, but no, it's pretty old tech that is shared, common in all sides, and it was 20 years ago at this point. So I actually emigrated. It was a long and bureaucratic process, analogous to getting a green card in the United States. So it took some 5 years at the time. It's actually a little easier right after I finished. They changed some of the laws. Bastards. It was by no means any kind of quick trade-off, easy deal, anything like that. It was a long bureaucratic slog entirely from my end.
Now, look, before we get into some of the analysis of the present-day situation, just give us, because I'm assuming that you return to the U.S. from time to time with family there and that sort of thing.
Nope. Nope, I have not been back to the United States in 20 years and really have no intention of ever going back. I talk to my parents every month or two on Skype, and that suits my needs just fine.
Okay, well, yeah, okay, so you've got some memories of life in the U.S.
I do.
Can you just compare the two? Can you compare the two, life in the U.S. to life living in Moscow, to an American city, for example?
Sure. I mean, I've lived in the U.S., I've lived in London, I've lived in Russia. Life is really, you know, for day to day, it's more or less the same everywhere. I mean, it's not like I get up and, I don't know, brush my teeth backwards or something bizarro world like that. Life is just about the same. I mean, compared to the United States, I would say that from where I grew up in what we call Pennsylvania, backwoods coal country Pennsylvania, of course, Moscow is a big, huge city of some 14 million people. So that's it would be a bit of a shock there if I wasn't used to cities like New York and London as well. The public transportation system is much better in Russia than it is in the United States, where it doesn't exist really at all. Of course, London also has a comparable public transportation system, although it's a bit complicated and expensive compared, I think, to its Moscow equivalent. The Moscow Metro is, I consider, one of the engineering wonders of the modern world, and it keeps growing every year because they keep investing more and more money in it. Other than that, I mean, there's some slight differences in foods that are eaten. You know, there's a little bit of cultural differences in the types of apartment buildings or, you know, flats and things like that. But, you know, it's not like life is hugely different in any of the three places.
Okay, so why have you chosen Moscow rather than New York or London?
Well, that's a good question. My wife is Russian, so that is a good reason right there. My ancestry is part Russian. I'm a Slavic mutt, so I guess you could say I felt a little bit of call to blood and culture. Some of my great grandparents come from Russia. As well, I would say a great deal of it is the politics. I prefer the politics and the society here to the United States or London, as shocking as that may be to some people. I am not a liberal, and I am not a conservative in the American Republican sense of a fundamentalist and a gun nut. I would guess with my specialty with international relations, my primary prism from which I view the political world is foreign policy, and the military. And I vastly prefer the Russian foreign policy, to what I consider the imperialist, if you want to say imperialist, I prefer, the pursuit of hegemony by the United States and its client states like the United Kingdom.
Well, that's a bit cheeky, isn't it? Calling us a client state, Mark?
No, I don't think. I think that's a pretty accurate description. I think, no offense, that you're a bunch of yapping lapdogs. When has the United Kingdom ever had a significant foreign policy difference from the United States, whether it was invading Iraq, whether it's ratcheting up tensions against Iran, or falling into some Thucydides trap thinking and creating a military conflict on the other side of the world in the Pacific Ocean right off China's coast? The United Kingdom is right there to back the United States up like a good little sidekick.
How does something like that work? How do the Americans say, well, we want the British to jump and the British say how high? How do they leverage that? How do they get that out of us?
I think it's perfectly willing. And I think a lot of European states react pretty much the same way. And I think the Trump years actually show that there is a little bit of the tail wagging the dog there. The British interference with the Steele dossier, the attempt to, not that Trump needed any slurring of his name, but to discredit any attempts he might make to change U.S. foreign policy. The British were very happy to see Trump leave and to see the hegemon return in its proper and expected form, I believe. Of course, there are some European states that, buck the reins a little bit, and you can see Germany with that, with their insistence on continuing the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And what do they get in return from their ostensible ally and partner? They get sanctioned. their companies get sanctioned. You're not allowed to do business with Russia because we know your energy security needs better than you do. We saw the same thing with the United States sanctioning Turkey for daring to buy a Russian missile defense system, the S-400 air and missile defense system. They've threatened to do the same to India. And they just did a drive-by of India's exclusive economic zone in the last week, claiming that India's, even though the U.S. doesn't follow the U.N. Convention of the Law on the Sea and is not a party to it, they claim that India's maritime claims are excessive. And this is their reward, I guess, for joining the Quad against China, targeting China. That is, that is the reward the hegemon hands out to its client states.
Now, you mentioned Nord Stream 2 there. This is something we hear a few blips on the news, but can you just explain what the geopolitical significance of it is and how, I mean, I don't really know myself. Is this something really important or not? You know, is it just a load of fuss the Americans are making about nothing?
It's hugely important in some ways. You have to consider that an energy pipeline is the surest form of energy supply and security. And it does, to a certain extent, really bind the political and economic of and interests of two countries together. It's certainly not all one-sided, right? Supplier and consumer, there is a leverage on both sides of that particular issue. The European Union it has ever-increasing energy supply needs, particularly gas, as they try to shift away from coal, which is a dirtier fossil fuel, much dirtier than gas. So the European Union, Germany's and the European Union's gas needs are ever increasing, as are other countries like China and so on. Now, for decades and decades, the Soviet Union and then Russia have been a very, by any academic sense of the word, reliable energy supplier, despite the Cold War and everything since, to Europe through existing pipelines across the land that were laid by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And in the last two decades, there have been a lot of complications with that energy supply, particularly with Ukraine. And at first, those complications were economic. Ukraine has long been an economic basket case ruled by oligarchs. And at several times in the past, they have simply not been able to pay their energy bills. And what they would do as a consequence is either politically grandstand and cut off the flow of gas themselves, Russian gas, to Europe, or to siphon off gas intended for Europe for their own needs. And that is the principal reason why Germany has agreed for the construction of two gas pipelines. The first one has already been built and is in effect, and the second one is, and the Nord Stream 2 is some 95% complete now. These pipelines run under the Baltic Sea into Germany, and then allowing Germany not only to have the gas for its own energy needs, but to serve as an energy gas and energy hub to distribute gas to the rest of the European Union, the continent. Now, the big problem for the previous transit countries, Ukraine and Poland here, one is that those pipelines gave them political and geopolitical leverage over both Russia and the rest of the European Union. They are losing that, particularly with the construction of the second pipeline. Further, there is the issue of gas transit fees. These are fees paid to Ukraine and Poland for transiting gas across their countries in pipelines that were built in the Soviet Union. And these rack up to billions of dollars a year. A great deal of it paid by Russia, by Gazprom, who shifted gas across. But there is, of course, a knock-on effect that the German and European energy consumers, end up paying for that gas transit as well, marking up prices on their end. And to give you an idea of the scale, the importance of this for a country like Ukraine, which does not have a very stellar economy to begin with, and then over the last few years since the West-backed Maidan putsch, which overthrew the democratically elected government there in 2014, the resulting political complications with their at the time largest state trading partner and still largest state trading partner, Russia, and the continuing conflict with the old industrial base of their own country, the Donbass, which has never acquiesced to the overthrow of the government that they had overwhelmingly supported there, the election of back in 2010. They have not agreed, they have not acquiesced at all to the new regime that is backed by the U.S. and the EU in Kiev, and that has complicated economic relations for them. So first, they have seen their GDP cut in half in the first 2 years since the Maidan. And they have since, on a GDP per capita basis, become the poorest country in Europe, poorer than Moldova. And that's saying something. So last year, these gas transit fees constituted some 18% of the Kiev regime's national budget for Ukraine. 18%, which means if they lose that gas transit fee, suddenly they're economically unsustainable. That's already counting the burden that they have. They are basically, the regime there is propped up by a spigot flow from the West through the IMF, which has shoveled tens of billions of Western taxpayer dollars into the regime there to try to keep it afloat. And now they're losing another 18% of their economy. It's simply unsustainable. That is why the regime there and its Washington, D.C. backer principally consider Nord Stream 2 a existential threat to the continuing Maidan regime in Ukraine. So the U.S. has done everything possible to try to kill this pipeline. Of course, there is the added bonus that they would much rather prefer that Germany buys their own LNG, liquefied natural gas, that they get from fracking and can ship across the sea. The only problem is that it's more than twice as expensive, which would make the German economy completely uncompetitive, in comparison to the United States, and raise the costs of everything, making a completely different economic situation. It's far more than just Germany. There have been six European state energy majors involved in this project. The French state energy major BP has involved and invested in this pipeline. The Italians, everyone has had a big piece of this pie because they all hope to profit from it and to gain energy supply in the end, with Germany serving as that type of energy hub. And in order to kill the pipeline, the United States, to try to kill it at some 95% complete, has tried to sanction not only the Russian companies, but all the European companies, state companies in many cases, that have been involved in its construction, with everything, from the ships laying the pipes to the quality insurance and legal inspections to make sure that it's legally sound, to even the hotels that would put up the employees from Gazprom. They'll sanction anything and everything in a desperate attempt to kill this pipeline, because it is very important for them. You have to understand what is, the proverbial purpose of NATO as a military political alliance, as they themselves stated it from the very beginning: to keep Germany down, to keep the Soviets, the Russians out of Europe, and to keep the United States in Europe. Besides the cost to their geopolitical project in Ukraine, the U.S. really does not want to see any better and stronger economic and political relations between Germany and Russia. And they are willing to sanction their own ally to see that through. From the Russian perspective, of course, they want a reliable energy consumer. They have, of course, invested very heavily in the last decade plus in providing energy to China. And they have the Russian-Chinese relations are the best they have ever been. But still, they are a pragmatic, realist, foreign policy-driven country, and they don't want to put all of their eggs in one basket. They would like to provide energy both east and west as part of their economic mix. And they are really, really tired of basically subsidizing a U.S.-backed regime very unfriendly to them and to the, it must be said, the ethnic Russians and all of the Eastern Ukrainians who have a very different conception of Ukrainian national identity, i.e. a very pro-Russian, you know, seeing Russia as a Slavic brother, as is the case in Eastern Ukraine. Russia is very much does not want to, as Putin said, continue to subsidize the U.S. Geopolitical project of constructing an anti-Russian Ukrainian nation.
Before we talk about what's going on in Ukraine now, though, can we just recycle it back to the end of last year with all the talk about Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, the new U.S. president's son, and his involvement in energy companies in Ukraine? Obviously, these big energy companies, I mean, okay, so we're talking here in the UK about things like, BP, Shell, these major people. A lot of people over the years have been suggesting that they really should be nationalized, that they should be kind of national infrastructure assets. But clearly they're not anywhere really in Europe. And that's been, a line that the Europeans ever since the Second World War just refused to cross. But can you just give us an idea of what Hunter Biden's involvement was in Ukraine? Because there's a lot of confusion about that. Some saying that it was just nothing. He's just doing, working for some business. Others saying that it's absolutely evidence of absolute corruption.
Yeah, it is pretty much evidence of absolute corruption. After the Yanukovych government, the democratically elected government of Ukraine, was overthrown in the West-backed putsch, which was unconstitutional, violent, and illegal, and is still not finally settled because the east of the country, the Donbass, has never been subjugated to that seizure of power. For the rest of Ukraine, Joe Biden, serving the Obama administration, served as effectively the viceroy of Ukraine. And, I think everyone has at this point seen, the videos of him giving talks about how he demanded that the Ukrainian government since change their attorney general or he would shut off the IMF money flow. And they did so. And I don't think you need any further demonstration of how subservient the Ukraine has been to the United States since.
Hang on a second, because that's pretty serious, isn't it? What you're saying is, in order to stop a prosecution, he's saying, well, I've got leverage with the international bankers, and if you don't sack this honest prosecutor with someone with integrity, that we will cut off the world's loans to you.
Well, I don't want to go out there and say someone with integrity, because no one involved in Ukrainian government, either before the Maidan putsch or since, has been some type of innocent. It's all interests, right? It's all loyalty to different oligarchs and political clans, and it's all a mess. But Hunter Biden was given a plum position on a very shady Ukrainian energy company, Burisma, which was under investigation for years in London, right? Or its listing on the stocks exchange there for its shady business practices and corruption. They eventually gave up only because the new attorney general that Biden had put into Ukraine didn't want to play ball at all and dropped the whole thing. But he did nothing. I mean, he never showed up. He was never there. He has no relevant experience, and no one could ever say what he actually did because he never did anything. He just collected, you know, a few million dollars for the Biden family for his name, for currying favor with Joe Biden. There is a lot of attempts to claim that there was not an active investigation that the then attorney general was pushing into Burisma. That's not at all true. I can't say that it was the most important issue on his plate, but it was certainly something that was on the docket and was being pursued at some level. And I don't think there's any question of that. I think claims to the contrary have been debunked. Now, whether that is precisely the reason why the only reason that Joe Biden and the U.S. wanted this attorney general removed, that's not necessarily clear, but that is certainly a conflict of interest. And none of this is illegal under either American or Ukrainian law, it must be said. Is it ethical? No, it's completely unethical. It's corruption that is perfectly legal in the sense, you know, that overthrowing a foreign government and serving as the viceroy and having them try to curry favor is legal. My big, as an outside perspective, not involved in U.S. domestic politics anymore, my biggest concern was more with the illegality of the overthrow of the government there and of the role the United States played in that and their funding of the civil conflict that followed, particularly being that a vanguard of that Maidan, of that political movement, are Western Ukrainian ultranationalists, which means literally Banderite fascists who lionize and heroize the Nazi collaborating West Ukrainians during World War II, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army that welcomed Hitler with open arms, participated in the Holocaust, the massacre of Poles, the mass killings of communists and Ukrainians who were part of not against the Soviet Union. So there's a big mess there. That is my issue. But I understand from the U.S. domestic angle, this became involved in this Democratic-Republican issue between Biden and Trump. And there is certainly something there. And even if it's not illegal, it is, of course, vastly unethical. And you have to understand that Hunter Biden is a piece of, shall we say, cow dung. I mean, the guy was kicked out of the military for his cocaine use. He's never really been successful at anything. He is likewise guilty of being given all kinds of plum positions involvement in Chinese banks that were also attempting to curry favor with Joe Biden. And, you know, that's how he got involved in it there. The guy is a piece of scum, but he's, and it has to be said that even Joe Biden, he was definitely Joe Biden's second favorite son before his first son died, in a tragic accident. The fact that this has not been recognized by the Democrats for partisan political reasons, and there has been an attempt to claim that there's nothing here and anyone who brings it up is Russian propaganda, it doesn't have to be Russian propaganda. You can just think it's corrupt and wrong for politician's son to be rewarded with plum positions, earning millions of dollars a year, doing literally nothing, never being involved with the company at all, just because you're his son. That is corruption to me, but again, there's really technically nothing illegal about it. It's just vastly unethical.
Yeah, we've seen quite a big shift, haven't we, since Biden took over from Trump at the end of January 2021, almost immediately in Ukraine. And then there's enormous tension on the border. Can you just take us through that, maybe some of the causes of it and what you think might happen?
Sure. The causes of it are pretty clear, and it's not because that Russia intends to invade Ukraine or take over the Baltics or anything like that. In fact, just in the last few hours, the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, has actually announced that the Russian military drills on the Ukrainian border have completed their exercises. They've done their purpose, which was actually deterrence, and they're standing down. They're starting returning to their bases tomorrow, and that will continue until the end of the month as they move out of the area. But the huge tension there has just gone out of the room in the last few hours before we're going on air here. So that may affect some of the way this whole thing has been painted and how wrong so many Western Russia experts have been as they try to present this as some kind of huge invasion threat and so on. But starting in early March, the Kiev regime in Ukraine began to build up military forces, shipping them to the east of their country to the contact line in Donbas, which has been a frozen conflict where there has been a tentative ceasefire, a pretty decent one for the last year up until the last couple of months. Under the Minsk Accords, which were an agreement between the regime in Kiev and the political leadership in Donbas to find a political reconciliation finally for what happened in the country in 2014. And the guarantors of this were France, Germany, and Russia, i.e. Russia was not a party to this. It was a guarantor. The parties to it are all Ukrainians, right? The regime in Kiev and the people in Donbas and East Ukraine. And this was, the best hope for a non-military solution to the continuing political crisis in that country. But the problem here is that the Maidan regime, which Zelensky inherited, was brought into power by a vanguard of West Ukrainian ultranationalists, Banderite fascists, and their conception of Ukrainian national identity is extremely anti-Russian. It's not necessarily pro-Western, but it's definitely anti-Russian. And that's the calculus that they made. They view anything giving decentralization of Ukraine, particularly to the Donbas as part of the Minsk Accords, as a capitulation to Russia, as treason. And they have given every indication, even if it was able to be pushed by Zelensky through the Ukrainian parliament, the Rada, that they would then rise up in revolt. And then there would be a second civil conflict in the country coming from the West this time. And the whole Maidan house of cards would come falling in. So for going on 6 years now, the regime in Kiev has given lip service to the Minsk Accords, but has not acted at all to fulfill them. The very first step is simply to sit down and begin discussions with the leadership, the political leadership in Donbas, and they refuse to do that, again, because it would be seen as capitulation. It would call into question their legitimacy, how power changed hands in 2014 and put them on an equal national stage. And the political balance in Ukraine, even without the Donbas, even without the Crimea, is extremely tenuous. Zelensky, the comedian turned president now of Ukraine, he came into office 2 years ago with a 75% approval rating. His approval rating, for various reasons, has dropped down to some 30%. And his political party that he created, Servant of the People, named after his comedy TV show where he played a school teacher that accidentally became the president of Ukraine before he actually did become the president of Ukraine, and that was not at all accidental, but an oligarch project by the Ukrainian oligarch Kolomoisky, Igor Kolomoisky. His approval rating has tanked due to the political crisis in the country, due to the constitutional crisis he's having in his war against the Supreme Court in that country, due to the economic problems, due to the pandemic and his inability to get vaccines, the unpopularity of lockdowns. The West had no intention of handing him any vaccines because it turns out Ukrainians are a really, really low priority for them. He refused to accept the Russian vaccine because he says it's hybrid warfare, you know, the whole idea of a better dead than red or Russian in this case. Whole lot of different crises in that country. His approval rating has tanked, and he faced the possibility of Nord Stream 2 being completed and the government of his regime, the government there, becoming unsolvable, losing 18% of its national budget if that came online. So he created this military political crisis, I believe, attempting to build up forces in East Ukraine, making the threat of launching a renewed military assault on the Donbas. And he even finally pulled out of the Minsk Accords. It was clear for the longest time that he wasn't going to settle it, but he pulled out completely, and he put into the national military doctrine of Ukraine that there was the intention of the government to recover both Crimea and Donbas by military force, you know, not political reconciliation, when it comes to the Donbas. So all of this was seen as a huge threat. The ceasefire started to unravel. The Ukrainian military was shelling the Donbas with mortars and artillery more and more, increasing on sniper fire. The ceasefire began. And then at the end of March, Russia began to counter by building up military forces on their side of the border, saying, at deterrence value, do not attack Donbas. Do not attempt to settle this by military force. We've been down this road before. You've agreed to the Minsk Accords. It's been solidified in UN Security Council resolutions. If you attempt to settle it by force and we see lots of East Ukrainians being killed, we will step in. And it has to be said that some 600,000 to 700,000 Eastern Ukrainians in the Donbas have also since taken Russian citizenship. So they are, in effect, dual citizens now. It is from Russian domestic political perspective, absolutely impossible that any Russian president wouldn't intervene and would allow, dual Russian citizens to be killed, by a West-backed regime in Kiev. So they would have to step in. You know, if you want to call that a tripwire, it certainly is, but it's also the fact that a lot of Eastern Ukrainians at this point would much rather be a part of Russia than be a part of Ukraine, though the Kremlin, for its own reasons, is not giving the Donbas that perspective. They don't want Donbas. They want it to be in Ukraine, just with a decentralized government there that would preclude it from joining NATO. So that is what this military buildup has been all about. It's been a deterrence Kiev has been screaming about it, and they've been playing up this invasion propaganda and for the last 2 weeks. And lo and behold, no invasion of Ukraine has taken place. Demonstrated their military strength. It wasn't actually even that big of a buildup in military terms. It was some 80,000 troops, according to the U.S. government, but some 50,000 of those, 25,000 troops in Crimea and 25,000 on the Russian-Ukrainian border the west of Ukraine, on the other side of Donbass, they're there anyway, and they've been there since 2014. In fact, the 25,000 troops in Crimea have been in Crimea before the Ukrainian government was overthrown in 2014, because that was part of the basing treaties that Ukraine had with Russia to give Russia, access to Sevastopol, their naval bases there. Russia has had 25,000 troops in Crimea for decades now, that hasn't substantially changed. The only real buildup was possibly around some 30 to 40,000 troops, which sounds like a big deal to a layman, but to someone who is involved with the military, that's a moderate military exercise. When you think about the force that the U.S., the U.K. and their allies used to invade Iraq, a similar sized population-wise country to Ukraine in 2003, there were some between the U.S. and the U.K. and their other allies, they had some 300,000 troops there to invade Iraq and then occupy the country. And that is a real invasion force. That is what one looks like. Some 80,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, at least half of which are already permanently stationed there. That is not an invasion force. That is a demonstrative force. If you want to call it coercive demonstration, that's fine, because, don't attack Donbass and return to the Minsk Accords, to the political reconciliation that you agreed in. But I believe that the reason that the Kiev regime, Zelensky, he did not believe that he could take Donbass by force. He knew at some point, even if his military was successful where it had not been previously, that Russia would step in. That was clear. But that's exactly what he wanted. He wanted a provocation that he could start a conflict in Donbass and bring Russia in, because the German government has been extremely unwilling to bow to U.S. sanctions and pressure, all of this Navalny poisoned with the most deadly poison in the universe with magic underpants and then miraculously coming back to life. All of that stuff failed to convince the German government to give up on Nord Stream 2. But a renewed military conflict where Russia directly, overtly stepped in to protect Donbass. Now, that would be very hard for the German government, any German government. And Angela Merkel is stepping down, and her party is probably going to lose to the U.S.-backed Green Party there in the next elections. I believe there was a hope that this would help them kill Nord Stream 2, that the German government would not be able to continue to support the project with a renewed military conflict there. I hope that the Russian military demonstration on the border deterred them from this goal. That's not finally written yet. At least the Russian side, having demonstrated that they are willing to step in but not going to immediately respond to provocations, is standing down at this point.
Interesting, Mark, you mentioned the US-backed Greens in Germany. This is Earth Day we're talking on, which is really reminds me more than anything else of the Michael Moore film that came out this time last year, Planet of the Humans, which looks at some of the attempts of the Western oligarchy to really, what we always used to call astroturf or greenwash, the whole environmental movement into something that they can turn into a money-making machine, and also, of course, a load of legacy equipment. For example, cars that run on diesel and petrol, make them all redundant and sell a whole new generation of electric vehicles to the population. This is one of the reasons that Tesla shares, and it's gone through the roof, and he's become the wealthiest man in the world, although, every day I look, I see he's going below Jeff Bezos and then above him again. But anyhow, what is it that you point to in Germany to say that the German Greens have got some sort of US backing?
That's actually pretty obvious, and actually representatives from Angela Merkel's own party have pointed to exactly that and said publicly that they are creatures of the Americans. Because now, I want to make clear that I myself consider myself, at least in environmental terms, a green. I don't bring on the rest of the liberal political baggage that's so often in the West there. But I'm extremely concerned by climate change, by environmental things. Russia sees climate change faster and more severe than any other country because of the amount of territory it has in the Arctic, where temperature change is the most prevalent. I've been very concerned with the international relations aspect of climate change for a very long time. But I do not see what the German Green Party support of every U.S. military action around the world has with a green agenda. I fail to see the connection between imperialism and environmental concern. In fact, the U.S. military is the biggest polluter on its own in the world. They have been adamant about also, of course, wanting to kill the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which makes no sense, because any climate change plan for a move to more, less carbon polluting, more sustainable, not sustainable because I don't believe in sustainability, but less carbon producing economies demands a further shift away from coal towards gas, at the very least as a stopgap fuel. Until they can actually make alternative energy actually work, which it really doesn't still at this point, not for national energy supplies anyway. So the fact, there is not a military action around the world that the German Greens for some reason do not support. And I fail to see the connection between support of U.S. military action around the world and an environmental agenda. That is why I consider the German Greens. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. You can take Angela Merkel's own party for it. And they've, of course, are not some great friend of the Russian government anyway. They just want this pipeline for their own energy security reasons. And they have, it must be said, they have also been loath to participate in U.S. military adventures around the world, be that in Iraq, in Syria, in Libya, or elsewhere. If the German Greens come to power, I think that would very much change.
Now, look, one of the things in the background to almost everything we've been discussing so far is this complete breakdown in diplomatic relations between Moscow and Washington, which I was looking at some of the historical records the other week, is unprecedented. Even since the Russian Revolution, the First World War time, there has been a Russian ambassador or a Soviet ambassador in Washington and a U.S. ambassador in Moscow. As of this week, there is not one of those in either. Both of the ambassadors have gone home, and it's indefinite.
Yeah, it certainly, there are a whole host of reasons other than this spat with the ambassadors being sent home after Joe Biden's quite hypocritical killer remarks about Putin. I'm much more you have to understand that, of course, there are diplomatic staff in each country. And in fact, the Russian government has called the American deputy ambassador to the Kremlin for a diplomatic dressing down this week. despite John Sullivan being on his way home. So diplomacy continues, even if it's, you know, not at the top tier of the ambassador level. But I'm far more concerned with things like pulling out of the international treaties, the arms control treaties that formed the Cold War security architecture. The U.S. pulling out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty unilaterally in 2003, which kicked off the new tech arms race starting back then, which Russia warned about at the time. Which made them delve heavily into the development of hypersonic weapons to counter, U.S. missile defense being laid very close to their borders. The U.S. pulling out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, not because of the nonsense about Russian violations, but because they want particularly conventional land-based intermediate range nuclear short and intermediate range missiles for what they view as an inevitable confrontation in the South Pacific with China. They see a huge missile gap there, and in that coming naval conflict, they want to have land-based missiles in Japan, in Guam, and elsewhere, and they view that as essential. That's why the Americans pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and the fact that they're already erecting missiles there shows that quite clearly. The U.S. pulling out of the Open Skies Treaty. At the very end, at least, Joe Biden kept the last foundation pillar, the New START Treaty. He renewed it, which is preventing a return to a quantitative arms race. It's the one that limits the amount of warheads and launch vehicles pointed directly at each other at any given time. Thank God for that little bit of sanity from the Biden administration there. But that's really just basic mutually assured destruction sanity at that point. But these are the type of things. The fact that these rules of the road are gone, that there is no fear and respect on both sides anymore. There is no respect. There is just continual demonization of both sides. The fact that the U.S. has erected 80-some packages of sanctions against Russia, that they are pursuing secondary sanctions against other countries just for doing business with Russia. That brings economic warfare to a whole new level. And despite the accusations of political meddling in U.S. politics via Facebook posts or something coming from the Americans, the reality is that America, of course, is the biggest meddler in the political affairs of other countries and elections around the world. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can take the researchers that have concluded that in reports at Carnegie Mellon. And shown that the U.S. By far is the biggest meddler in other countries' elections and politics, not even counting regime change, color revolutions, and invasions and the like. And Boris Yeltsin, his re-election in Russia, miraculously, in what is widely viewed to be a rigged election, is the clearest point of that meddling. Of course, it continues with Navalny and so on to this day. But if you'll remember the Time magazine cover of the Americans crowing how they got Boris Yeltsin reelected and we saved Russia from the communists, they celebrate their meddling. I mean, there was a movie made about it where they're very, very, very proud of what they did. So all of this bit about and then, of course, the lunacy of the most aggressive cyber hacking and cyber warfare country in the world complaining about cyber espionage by any other country is really just silly. It's Russia has proposed, Putin has proposed to the last three U.S. presidents, Obama, Trump, and Biden already, let's create an international cyber treaty to analogous to arms control to settle cyber warfare and cyber espionage. Either we stop it, or we agree to set rules of the road, what is allowed and what isn't, and stop the meddling in each other's countries that way. And of the Americans immediately blow that off. One, because of course they want to continue doing it because they think they have a duty and a moral right to do so to Russia and other countries. And on the other hand, they say that it is impossible to correctly attribute any act of cyber warfare or cyber espionage in most cases around the world. At the same time that they continually blame Russia for everything. So I see this fail to see the logic. They're lying about something, whether they're not able to find correct attribution or the blaming of Russia. You take your pick. But it's the U.S. who is not willing to enter into negotiations about an international cyber treaty that have been repeatedly proposed by Russia. So these are the types of tensions that I'm actually far more worried about than the current diplomatic steps with ambassadors. But never lose sight that we are in a new arms race. We have been since 2003. And it involves hypersonic weapons, hypersonic glide vehicles, developments in artificial intelligence by the militaries on both sides. Again, this is not really just a block Cold War yet. At this point, it is still a great power conflict with multiple players all pursuing these technologies. The US, the EU, Russia, China, India, even some big regional players like Turkey are becoming, you know, big drone powers and the like. We are in a new arms race. And I believe it is the US that with its building up of tensions and confronting China in the South China Sea, confronting Russia in Ukraine and the Black Sea, continually pursuing conflict with Iran. It's the U.S. that is seemingly against its own interests trying to push us back into a bloc world where they are not giving countries like Russia, China, Iran, Venezuela, Syria, North Korea any other option but to ally with each other to survive. And I have to say that from the Russian perspective, I'm very glad actually for that, because I view cooperation, the strategic partnership with China, is absolutely essential for securing Russian sovereignty from U.S.-led Western hegemony in the medium to long term.
Okay, look, we had a election for a Conservative leader here in Britain back in 2019, and Boris Johnson won. The guy that came second was the former Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, who then went on to become Defence Secretary. But he came second, and last week he was in conversation with a certain Mr. Henry Kissinger, and it was quite interesting to hear the Kissinger-esque pronouncements there, where he's saying, look, unless the world gets around my COVID-19, it's basically an agreement around the world for everybody to sort of go along with various security measures, etc., to do with COVID, that there could be an international conflict. Now, I'm always a bit concerned with Kissinger, given that he is, you know, this war criminal from various conflicts, you know, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, Indonesia, the absolute creation of hell in Indonesia, as well as, of course, Chile, etc., etc. Really, the list goes on and on. And, of course, he's one of the key figures in the supposedly now disappeared Bilderberg conferences. But as to whether Kissinger is actually gently warning people, or whether this is a kind of veiled threat. Do you think he's still a force? And if so, what do you make of his warning that unless we get together around the world to deal with COVID-19 together, that there's bound to be a major falling out, potentially even a war around the world over it.
Well, I guess a pandemic can be viewed as being an exacerbating condition. Although actually in the last year, if anything, it is, I think it's actually dampen down more conflicts, at least in the very short term, like in Syria and Idlib and so on. I hadn't heard about this. I don't think Kissinger actually has that much influence today. In fact, one of the things he has been pushing for the last few years on a different angle, he was particularly pushing this to Trump, and I think it partially at least explains Trump's personal motivations for trying to improve relations with Russia, even if his neocon administration did the exact opposite. Kissinger has been pushing that he sees China as the big threat to the United States, and he wants the U.S. to pull what is referred to as a reverse Kissinger. During the Cold War, Kissinger and Nixon came up with the luring China into the Western geopolitical camp, basically taking advantage of some political disagreements between the Soviet Union and China. And there are many people who credit that Sino-Soviet split engineered by Kissinger as actually the principal deciding point in the first Cold War. But at the time, Kissinger even said, and he is certainly reiterating it now, 30 years down the road, we will have to – well, he actually at the time, I think he said 20 years. We will have to do the opposite, and we will have to ally with the Soviet Union against China. We will have to split the other way then. And that's what he's been pushing for some time now, that in order to defeat China, that the West needs to find common cause with Russia. Now, that is not a possibility. That possibility has come and gone, and neither or Russia or China are going to allow themselves to be split at this point. But that is one of the things, for instance, that he has been pushing in Washington. He tried to push it to Trump, and he has tried to push it to since, and they're paying absolutely no attention to him whatsoever. So I don't think he really has that much influence left. And I don't know about how he might have affected U.S. or U.K. coronavirus policy. I don't think he has at all. But he certainly hasn't affected Russian. I mean, Russia developed its own vaccine. It has nothing to do with Bill Gates. Russia has had its own good and bad implementation of things like lockdowns and building up its state healthcare infrastructure to deal with the situation, and is probably going to benefit from selling its own vaccine around the world, although the U.S. is doing its best at this point to pressure other countries not to use either the Russian or Chinese vaccines. It's amazing to see geopolitics played out in which countries accept which vaccines for use for their own citizens. But you pull up that map and you get a very interesting perspective of the world right now, and how even something as innocuous as vaccines is becoming a big geopolitical football.
It certainly is. What do you make, though, of the disappearance of the Bilderbergers over the last year and a bit? They've vanished off the face of the earth. Have they done their job? Are all the NATO country leaders now dancing to their tune?
I have to admit, I don't really pay a whole lot of attention to the Bilderbergers as an organization. I believe that there is some level of organization there, of camaraderie, of collaboration, of various political and economic elites again. But in the end, it's in the pursuit of U.S.-led Western hegemony, which has other aspects than just the informal Bilderberg collusion on that. So that aspect of it, I don't pay a whole lot of personal attention to, although I don't completely discount it either. And I would say that you're probably a much better expert on that than I am.
Okay. Look, Mark, whereabouts can people go to get, do you think? I mean, we're all fed up with watching the half-truths and actually the downright lies we've been getting on the mass media, particularly to do with international coverage But whereabouts can you recommend some sites to go, websites generally or TV channels to get some half decent information to, you know, so we can stay abreast of events, and also, you know, your own channels too, where you're writing, where we can find your work?
Yeah, so I do not believe in any one source of information, be it Russian. I do prefer it to some, but by no means is it a objective truth with a capital T. I don't even believe in that. I believe in interests, be they political, ideological, economic, corporate, everything. I think your best is to take from a wide variety of sources and then make some type of comparison in your own head. That's
yeah. Okay. Look. Okay. Give us. Recommend us a few, though. Come on. I'm not letting you get away that easily.
Yeah. Okay. No. That's fine. I was getting there. I was just taking the long, circuitous route. Follow me. I'm on Facebook and Twitter at Mark Sloboda One. I do a lot of different media. I'm on France 24, Al Jazeera, RT. I'm on Sputnik several times a week on their radio shows. I do a lot of podcasts. I do a lot of different things. Follow me. I like Moon of Alabama. I find that Moon of Alabama, you can find it on the, with an easy Google search, a lot of geopolitical commentary there. He and I agree like some 90% plus of the time. I think he is an excellent source. And other than that, it depends on what the particular issue is, and, you know, the particular countries involved. The Institute for Responsible Statecraft and the Kinsey Institute in the United States, despite my questions about their oligarch backing and why they're backing it, they do some fabulous work. I know a lot of the people who are involved there. I definitely recommend following them on Twitter and reading, or whatever is your preferred social media choice, and reading regularly anything that they write. The Kinsey Institute, a lot of good people there. Daniel Larison is an American realist who is also involved there on Russia. Anatoly Lievin, he is in there as well. Also, take a look at Stephen Walt. Stephen Walt is a realist at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and he is always definitely someone worth reading with a sane, realist foreign policy perspective from an American point of view. I take a lot from these people, and I think that you can find a lot by credible people, even if they aren't the people that are in power or anywhere close to it. There are still some respectable academics and professionals out there that you can follow and learn something from.
Look, Mark, I've got to ask you this one, though. The origins of COVID, what do you think? Is it lab leak? Was it deliberate? Is it not? Or is it just some sort of natural thing?
Oh, Jesus. I honestly don't know. God knows that we have seen a lot of viruses come out in the last few years. And with, the population and globalization and all the global travel, that's not surprising. We take a look at SARS 1 and 2 and the fact that coronavirus could have been naturally occurring, certainly, but we also know that both the Americans and the Chinese were both doing research on engineering COVID, coronaviruses themselves, ostensibly for reasons of prevention, right, of getting ahead of the curve. But let's be honest, the U.S. is really, really heavily involved in biological warfare, and they were involved in creating coronavirus variants in South Carolina at their bio labs there. In Wuhan, there was certainly a bio lab, and the U.S. was even involved in funding that there. I honestly don't know. At this point, whether it was biological, natural occurrence or a manufactured biological weapon that escaped from a lab. At this point, I have to say I'm far more concerned with logical, realist, pragmatic ways of dealing with it than I am in attributing any particular origin to it.
Okay, Mark Sloboda, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure.